Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Closer look at Starbucks, the coffee and the culture that fuels so many Americans. But first, facing growing consumer outrage and concern among politicians, President Bush is pledging to investigate why gas prices nationwide are so high. In a speech this morning, the president proposed some short-term solutions, such as temporarily halting deposits to the nation's strategic petroleum reserve, which he says would make that oil available to consumers. And before an audience of ethanol industry leaders, he floated some long-term alternative energy sources, such as corn-based ethanol.
You know, there's no doubt in my mind that one of these days, instead of people driving up to a gas station, they're going to be going up to a fueling station. And they'll be able to have choices to choose from. You've got a hydrogen, powered car, you'll be able to have that choice. If you want 85%, maybe someday 100% ethanol, that'll be an option available too. We owe it to the American people to be aggressive on price gouging now. We owe it to the American people to be promoting alternative ways to drive their cars so as to make us less dependent on foreign sources of oil.
Well, joining us on the line now is Tom Cloza. He's publisher and chief oil analyst for the Oil Price Information Service. And Tom, let's pick up on that president's comment right there about the future use of ethanol and hydrogen. You know, both have their critics. Your thoughts on that comment?
Well, he was playing to the crowd, certainly, in front of the Renewable Fuels Association. He didn't make any mention of the notion that it costs about $1.10 or $1.15 to make ethanol from corn, and it's selling for about $2.70 a gallon or $2.80 a gallon, of which 51 cents is a federal tax subsidy, but I wouldn't expect him to. You know, I think ethanol is a very small part of the solution down the road. There's some science that questions exactly how much energy goes into producing ethanol, and we've got probably a diesel fuel crisis that's around the block in 2006-2007. But I think that ethanol is probably a problem this year in terms of the transition, but it'll be something that might temper some of the gasoline increases down the road, but not because of some sort of wonderful beneficence among the corn folks, but because it's tremendously profitable to manufacture at the moment.
It costs a lot of money. Well, what else jumped out at you after the president's speech today?
Well, I mean, the two things that I thought were substantive as opposed to the boilerplate were the mention of not loading the Strategic Petroleum Reserve with any more crude. One might question why that wasn't done a while ago. It is a modest amount that goes in there, but generally it makes sense to fill it up when prices are subdued and not when prices are in sort of a runaway atmosphere, which they are right now. And secondly, the relaxation of waivers or using the bully pulpit to nudge the EPA to sort of grant more discretion with some waivers. I think on a short-term basis that helps, and it's not as environmentally damaging as some folks might think. A lot of these problems with gasoline grades, have to do with sort of a lifespan of a week or two and running on empty before you replace it with the new blend.
Well, a nudge to the EPA, but some would wonder, was he tough on industry? Did he call for windfall tax or for Congress to take back subsidies?
Well, no surprise there. I don't think he was too tough on industry, and he did not call for any windfall profits tax, although he did make mention of getting rid of the $2 billion in terms of the subsidies that had been grandfathered in that were passed by Congress recently. Now, that's $2 billion over 10 years, and if my math is right, we'll probably spend about $15 billion more this month than we did in the same month of 2003 in terms of motorist fuel bills. So you have to keep these numbers in perspective. But no, he wasn't tough on anyone in the business community in terms of production.
How was the speech perceived, do you think? Because we noted that gas future prices for June delivery dropped 8% after he gave a speech.
Well, that's really where the public has this wrong. I mean, they do believe that oil companies have been acting collusively or in tandem, but really it's been the financial markets and the oil market, which is just a multi-trillion dollar market, which has been sort of carrying the water for refiners and producers. You know, they're not making $60 to $65 a barrel profit on crude because they're doing something collusively. They're making it because that's what the market is evaluating at, and the same thing with gasoline profits. So, I kind of found the notion of investigations to be just sort of going through the motion. They're going to investigate. They're going to find that companies didn't act collusively, but they're going to find that the investment community is valuing oil to the extreme, and it's valuing gasoline to the extreme.
Tom Kloza, publisher and chief oil analyst for the Oil Price Information Service, after the president's speech today. Tom, thank you.
Take care.
Starbucks. For many, it's a blight on their local landscape, a cookie-cutter coffee chain wiping out local color while marching to global domination with 11,000 outlets in 37 countries. For others, though, it's an indispensable dispenser of their daily caffeine fix. Why has Starbucks become so addictive for so many people? Well, history professor Bryant Simon of Temple University in Philadelphia set out to find the answer to that question. His journey has taken him to 300 Starbucks in six countries, his research uncovering not just the secrets of Starbucks, but a look at Americans, who we are. But before we talk to Professor Simon, we decided to stop by the Starbucks on our corner here in Boston, where Boston University students were fueling up before their morning classes.
Just got a grande cafe mocha. I get about one a day.
This girl drinks more Starbucks than anyone I know.
The coffee's good. I've heard a lot of people dog it, but I really think it's the best coffee around.
We go to school, the School of Music. We need to live on coffee.
I think just the chill atmosphere, the calm music, the great coffee, I think just, I don't know, makes a setting that's good for conversation.
Actually, I think it's like overpriced coffee, and I feel obligated to buy it when I come here. I come here for the atmosphere, and then like I buy the coffee out of obligation.
I get dressed up before I come to Starbucks just because the image that it creates. I think when you walk in the store, your mood definitely changes because you have to fit the persona of like going with the flow, trendy, the music they keep, like jazz, fusion, blues, everything. It's all about newness, and I think the best way to put it is it's harder not to go to Starbucks than it is to go.
This is sounding weird, but I like the smell that leaves my clothes. And I really do. Like, if they made, like, a Starbucks perfume, I'd probably buy it.
Starbucks perfume. Well, joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia is Bryant Simon. And, Professor, as you listen, did anything there resonate with you after all of your research?
Well, that's a great piece of tape. Yeah, a lot resonates. I made a list. Some go for the music, some go for the store, some go to dress up, so they're going for an image, some go for the atmosphere itself, and they don't even buy anything, so others probably go to study, so they're renting real estate, and the perfume line is great. She likes the smell, and Starbucks is trying to create, I mean, you have to think of it in many ways like a multimedia production. They're not just selling coffee, they're selling, at least they think they are, an experience. So that they're trying to engage every sense in that process.
Well, and it's working, at least according to the persons we just heard from, especially I'm thinking of the young man who said, you go in there and you feel as if you have to dress and everything to be part of this hip, chill atmosphere, I think someone said. Well, I want to talk more about your methodology, your research. We kept a log. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, pick a space in your log and tell us what you wrote?
All right. I just picked a page. I was in Pensacola, Florida, 511. This place is consistently happening. Back at the Starbucks at 9th Avenue and Bayou Boulevard. A couple sitting close together on a leather couch. She has her arm around him. They seem so casual for a public setting. A white guy next to them with a buzz cut is sitting, reading, and sipping a large, cool, frothy concoction. At a large table, there are two people working on an Excel spreadsheet. He has a white shirt and a BlackBerry. At another table, a single white guy in a flowered shirt is on the phone talking about laying a floor.
So business, romance?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, I'm not kidding, I've seen a half dozen breakups in Starbucks over the last 18 months.
Why did you decide to start investigating this aura of Starbucks?
Well, I was really interested in public life. I was interested in where we go and how we talk and how we connect with each other. And I was finishing a book about Atlantic City where I was trying to think about those questions. And one morning, a New Year's Day morning, I went hungover to Starbucks and saw what I thought was some form of community taking shape. Then wanted to ask the question, what it meant if this was our community, what were the implications of it being corporately controlled and conceived?
You spoke of thinking that Starbucks was a new kind of public space. What does that mean, public space?
Public spaces are the kind of places where we can gather, usually free, and almost anyone can go. And in those places, ideally, our sense of kind of separateness breaks down and we develop ties to the community. A sociologist here in Philadelphia, Elijah Anderson, calls them cosmopolitan canopies, where we let down our guard against others and then hopefully develop a kind of tolerance connection that moves to another place. Now, I'm not sure that always happens at Starbucks, but Starbucks says that's what they're trying to do.
Right. They're trying to build a community. And we just heard from these young people who said they felt that sense of community there. But I can hear other people shouting, but it's not a community. It's a business. In fact, it's a fake community.
Lots of communities are kind of resistant to Starbucks. Some think it's almost too downmarket for the real estate in their communities. For instance, Jude Law's neighborhood in London tried to keep Starbucks out. As Starbucks moves everywhere, it loses the scarcity factor. And in scarcity, there's value. And as more and more people go, it's losing some of its kind of upmarket resonance, so much so that some of the richest, most privileged communities in America want Starbucks out, because what's valuable now is independent local shops. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's whole communities that are fighting to get Starbucks in. A small town outside of Philadelphia here that's a little down on its heels recently staged a rally where 200 people held up placards that said, got location, need Starbucks.
And this goes to the thing that you were talking about, this thing you've called consuming belonging, this sense of community. And by the way, I was struck by the fact that part of your inspiration was from seeing the movie Crash.
That opening line in Crash, I think, is really interesting, where the character says, we're so desperate for a touch that we crash into people. And I think that's true. And I think what Starbucks offers is this sense of belonging. And the first way you do it is by mastering the language. That once you master it, you're in.
Now time for disclosure. I'm not a coffee drinker. What do they say in Starbucks? What is the language of Starbucks?
Half-calf lattes, no foam, extra hot, with a triple shot of chocolate. I'm sure I got that drink wrong. They try and sort of use a language that sounds Italian to gain a sort of sophistication to the drinks.
I gotcha.
So venti means 20. It's for a 20-ounce drink, but I don't think that's why Starbucks is using it. I think Italian, cool, drink it, you become cool.
Right.
But if you listen long enough, people order very intricate drinks. And in fact, people who work at Starbucks have told me the more intricate drink, the more people almost identify with the brand. What's interesting about that, we're going for belonging, and Starbucks actually nurtures that belonging. They coach the people who work there to remember the names of customers. They coach them to remember drinks, so when you walk in the morning, you're immediately recognized and your drink is made. That's a kind of corporate form of belonging, but as soon as you stop buying, you no longer belong to the community. And that's an example of sometimes Starbucks is almost an illusion factory. It promises to meet some of our desires, but only with the kind of thinnest illusionary experience.
Brian Simon is history professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. His book, Consuming Starbucks, is due out in 2008. When we come back, Starbucks and politics. Is the Harlem Starbucks, for instance, all about making a middle class feel good about buying a $3 latte in their suburbs rather than providing coffee culture to low-income neighborhoods? Much more coming up with Brian here and now. Professor Brian Simon talking about America's obsession with Starbucks. And Brian, it seems there's some irony here because there are so many people who hate Starbucks for forcing small local coffee shops out of business and taking local dollars out of communities. But before Howard Schultz bought Starbucks in 1987 and helped it go global, it was an independent kind of, you know, Birkenstock kind of business.
Well, it really was a Birkenstock company. I mean, it was very Ben and Jerry's-like. It started out in 1971, three kind of hippies go from San Francisco to Seattle. They were Pete's devotees, and they get to Seattle, and there's no good coffee, and they said, well, let's start selling bulk coffee. Later, Schultz would come in and kind of, in many ways, change that culture and make it a bit more corporate, but also it's hard to grow something to 11,000 stores and retain a countercultural ethos.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you came to these conclusions, how you did your research. What would you do? You would just
I do Google searches, and look at blogs.
People blog, write online about Starbucks?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
What do they say?
I mean, some we can't repeat. Some they talk about how much they love it. People define themselves. There's a place where you can go and put in your drink, and it'll tell you what kind of personality you have. So I drink just drip coffee, and it says I'm boring. If you run a Google search on any aspect of Starbucks, say Starbucks and bathrooms, which is something that's interesting to me because people often talk about Starbucks as our new public bathroom. Starbucks offers you a rather spacious single bathroom. That's a way that they're communicating with their customers that they care, but also it's a symbol of kind of opulence. To waste space suggests you have money. And in a sense, you're renting that space and getting the aura of that opulence by going to Starbucks.
We talked about communities that didn't want Starbucks there and communities that were begging Starbucks to come. Starbucks has an agreement to set up locations in largely African-American communities through an arrangement with Magic Johnson, who's mm-hmm. quite the entrepreneur in Los Angeles. But you say the Harlem Starbucks is one of the worst you've ever been to in the world. Why do you think that is?
The Harlem Starbucks, which got a lot of press and got a lot of attention for Starbucks' diversity program, was one of the smallest footprints I've ever been in, but it was also one of the kind of grimmest stores. And just from the outside, Starbucks generally has floor-to-ceiling windows. People can look in and see that it's a safe place. But in less safe neighborhoods, architects will notice you have much more brick and less window. So that was the first thing I noticed. There was a lot of brick and not much window. The store itself had none of the soft seating that we often associate with Starbucks, the couches and the comfy chairs. There wasn't even any music playing. And this was an interesting kind of parable for race in America. I mean, Starbucks at one level gets all this credit for its kind of attention to details of race, and then it puts in the most famous African-American spot in America really the most down-on-his-tooth store that it is. And I was kind of shocked by that.
You think that it was just for publicity?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. What I do think is that part of the point of the store was to appeal to customers who like the idea of diversity. In post-civil rights America, and again, here's something that I think Starbucks reveals about who we are, we like to think of ourselves as tolerant, and we participate in that tolerance often through consumption. So, you know, we eat Thai food, we eat Mexican food, therefore we're tolerant of those cultures. And Starbucks, in a sense, allowed white liberals to imagine their tolerance by consuming the product of a store that was so gracious as to put a location in Harlem. I'm not necessarily suggesting this is sinister on Starbucks' part. I'm suggesting that they understand that they're selling desire as much as coffee. And they understand what those desires are. Someone once said of Walt Disney that he knew us better than we know ourselves. And I think at times that could be said about Starbucks.
Well, and Brian Simon, you've spoken of Starbucks as being, you know, representative of consuming belonging, the idea that, you know, we're desperate for human contact, so we make believe we're getting coffee when we're trying to get more than that, that the company is selling it as, you know, a new sense of public space. But we spoke to a person at the Starbucks in this area who also added that Starbucks for them, conveyed spirituality. Let's listen.
Here, it's a non-threatening atmosphere. We can feel free to, you know, talk about spiritual things, and people won't look at us weird. So I think Starbucks is good for that.
Brian Simon, Starbucks as the new place of worship?
Well, there's a pastor trying to get people to Easter services, gave out Starbucks certificates, and it was a rousing success. So maybe we're not that far off. I have seen a lot of church groups in Starbucks.
We mentioned that Starbucks is around the world. How is it different around the world? How does it either accommodate or change to fit the country that it's in?
Starbucks itself doesn't change a lot, but customers use it differently. Starbucks here, the majority of customers are grab and go, which would suggest that people sitting there in many ways are kind of props to make them feel good. In Europe, or in Spain particularly, very few people grab and go. It's just not part of the culture. Same in Tokyo. So it can become a destination place. And my favorite sort of destination story is in Guadalajara, Mexico, people valet park to go to Starbucks.
Do people feel like, that they're supporting an American company? Do they see it as their own? I mean, how do they view it?
Well, Starbucks never had the McDonald's kind of Americanness to it or the Disney Americanness to it. It's American in the sense that it plays American music, it's in English, and it's excessive. You know, I mean, for a lot of people, what they associate with Americanness is just the size, right? You know, everything's big in America, big cars. So they got big muffins, by drinking excess, you're sort of acting like an American.
Brian, I'm wondering, all your research and all your, you know, the logging of miles and the logging of what you see in the Starbucks, you obviously think it's going to tell us something about ourselves. What is it telling us about you?
I don't know. I think you stumped me. This is my third book. I don't know that I'm any more or less obsessed with this than I was with other topics. My colleagues in history think I'm not doing history anymore and are somewhat bemused by that.
Well, and why would you tell – what would you say to them about why this is worth your scholarly time?
I'd say I have tenure. I mean, it's worth my scholarly time because what we buy tells us about who we are. I mean, I do think there's a lot to be revealed in that, and I think there's a lot to be revealed in the kind of dance between Starbucks and its customers. So if I can reveal something about where we are in America today, where our political culture is, where public life is, where our sense of belonging is, where the organization of space is, then I've done something of value.
Brian Simon, history professor at Temple University, doing research on a book called Consuming Starbucks. It'll be published in 2008. Brian, we can't wait.
Thank you. Well, I hope to come back then.
And we don't have to wait for you guys. You're already writing. Send us your thoughts at here-now.org. We just heard from a listener who says it seems to have all the appeal of a McDonald's, but Starbucks does provide health care to some part-time employees. Isn't that good? Write us. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Bob.
My name is Paul Rusesabagina. I'm a hotel manager. In April 1994, when a wave of mass murder broke out in my country, I was able to hide 1,268 people inside the hotel where I worked. When the militia and the army came with orders to kill my guests, I took them into my office, treated them like friends, offered them beer and cognac, and then persuaded them to neglect their task that day. And when they came back, I poured more drinks and kept telling them they should live in peace once again. It went on like this for 76 days.
And so begins the new autobiography of Paul Rusesabagina, the man whose story was made famous by the movie Hotel Rwanda. His book is called An Ordinary Man, and it tells how Paul, through an extraordinary mix of courage and cunning, was able to shelter and save 1,268 people by holding them in the Hotel Mille Collines where he was the manager. 12 years after the mass killings in Rwanda, Rusesabagina is once again fighting genocide, but this time it's happening right now in Darfur, Sudan. And Paul, welcome back.
Thank you.
It's so good to talk to you again. And it's been a while since the killings in Rwanda, the events of April 1994. What is it that you think did save the people that you were able to save?
Well, I believe myself in the powers of words. I believe that with words, you can do a lot of good things as well as a lot of harm.
Well, you write in your book that that's what you did. You talked. I mean, you also handed out liquor, you know, cases of champagne. You gave money to people. You called in chits, you know, from people you'd made friends with. But most important, you used words, you say. You pleaded, you coaxed, you cajoled, you negotiated, you said what you had to say to people to keep people from being killed. Are you saying that doing that in other places like Darfur, talking to people, will save lives?
Definitely, that would save lives. In Africa, we do not necessarily need the Marines. What we need from the superpower leaders is to convey a strong message, for instance, to those African dictators. Let them know that they are not untouchable. So far, I have never seen any such strong message, but there is a hope. Since a few days ago, one of the most known dictators of Africa, Charles Taylor, has been arrested, brought to justice. That is a message from the international community, because what we need from the international community is, for instance, to do what they did in the former Yugoslavia when they caught Milosevic just as acting as the president. That is a stronger message. If any president, any dictator in Africa can get such a message, no one else will ever frustrate his people. Most of those people, again, they have their money, they steal from their own countries. This money is always brought to the West. It is maybe in America, maybe in Europe, in many different countries. Why can't we send another message and let them know that this money is not their money and we can freeze it in the West anytime, since they are stealing from their people and frustrating them, killing them? That would be another strong message.
Well, how do you apply what you learned about Rwanda to Darfur and Sudan? We hear that conflict explained as a conflict between the Arab militias who have all the power, run the government, and the black African farmers. How would you apply what you've learned to that conflict?
Unfortunately, history ever keeps on repeating itself and does never teach us a lesson. What I saw in Rwanda, I was seeing in Rwanda between 1990 and 1994, the rebels' army butchering everybody, fleeing, is exactly what is happening in Darfur. When I went to Darfur last year, I was very much ashamed to notice that 2 million people had been displaced within Darfur. Those people don't even have the right to be called refugees because they are still within their country. A refugee is someone who can be helped by the international community, is the one who has crossed his country's border. Just like Rwanda, on the ground, you can see government helicopters destroying villages with bombardments. There is a militia armed by the government, exactly like in Rwanda, and that militia on horses are killing people fleeing, burning villages.
This is the Arab Janjaweed. Well, so
the Arab Janjaweed.
Paul, would you say that you would, for instance, confront members of the Arab militia and talk to them, try to cajole them, stand between them and the Muslim farmers that they are attacking? It sounds so simplistic to say that.
No, I wouldn't. My solution, if I had the powers, I wouldn't approach the militia themselves, because the militia has got a boss. Their boss is the Khartoum government. They are armed, they are motivated, or paid by the government. So the most responsible people are the government and not the militia, because the militia depends on the government.
And so who should talk to who?
The superpower leaders should dare have the courage to tell the Sudanese government, you are killing your own people. You are not untouchable. You can one day face justice like anyone else.
So when you say words, you're not necessarily saying, words like, sit down and have something to eat. You're saying words that carry threats as well.
Yes. In however you want to use words, they can always work.
And in Darfur, you say that countries need to use words to both threaten the government in Khartoum and also get the parties there to talk. I wonder, when you saw the Darfur genocide unfolding, having lived through one yourself, what was your reaction?
I was very much humiliated, very much ashamed to see that what I had been seeing 11 years before was still happening. And what made me again ashamed was the fact that when on my way back, all the superpower leaders were gathered in Auschwitz in Poland, remembering the 60th anniversary of the Jewish Holocaust. And all those people who spoke repeated at least 10 times two words, never and again. It is high time that we stop talking only, but we join words with action.
Paul Rusesa Bigina, the manager of the Hotel Mille Collines during the Rwandan genocide in 1994. He saved 1,268 lives by sheltering people in a place built to house only 300. His new book, memoir, An Ordinary Man, is just out. Paul, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we should say Paul also wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal recently in which he also called for the UN to have a light military force able to respond to genocide. Fascinating reading. Fascinating man. Stay with us. Much more ahead, including Broadway's Patti LuPone. You're listening to Here and Now. Standing room only. It's a designation usually reserved for rock concerts, but it might be coming to an airplane near you. Today, the New York Times reports that aircraft manufacturer Airbus is considering including standing room only seats in some of their airplanes as part of an ongoing effort to boost revenues by getting more passengers onto planes. Now, Airbus denies the report, but the Times quotes several Asian carriers saying that Airbus offered them the seating, and experts claiming to have seen the proposal describe passengers harnessed to an upright padded backboard. So, is it just a matter of time before standing room only seats become the norm? Well, joining us first is Mary Ann Gretchen, a spokesperson for Airbus. Mary Ann, Airbus says what to this report?
Well, first of all, I just love creative writing in a major newspaper. It's very enlightening to know that all the creativity hasn't gone out of the press.
There's no truth to this.
There is no truth to the facts, or I should say that I misused word. There is no truth to the story that Airbus is offering standing room seats to our passengers. We are not doing it quietly, as that article suggested, and we are not doing it loudly.
It
is nowhere on the drawing board. A good backup for that is last month, on March 26th, our big new plane, the double-decker, the A380, we evacuated 853 people and 20 crew very successfully in an evacuation drill. And all those people were seated. And that is the maximum that would ever be put on the plane. And it is so highly unlikely that seating configuration would ever be used. There's no reason even to consider a standing room only seat.
You're referring to the new A380 double-decker jet you're in the process of introducing that can hold up to 853 passengers compared to about 500. And the Times says the 500 that you can fit in with traditional seats. So you're saying that you can fit 853 passengers without these backboard stand-up things?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but Marianne, here's the question. Can you fit their knees?
Yes, you can. Now, again, that 853 number is something that we will likely never see on an A380. For instance, the 747 is the regulations say that you can put up to 660 people on that plane. There is nobody in the world who's flying that aircraft with 660 passengers.
Yeah, why do you want a plane for 853 people when we see, planes that are leaving empty and ticket prices skyrocketing because of oil costs skyrocketing and, that's going to take a lot of fuel? Why do you want a plane with 853 passengers? Why are you looking at that?
Well, fuel costs is a big reason that you do want to put a lot of people on a plane, because it costs a lot less money to put a lot of people on one plane than it does fewer people on a couple of different planes. So you got to make bigger planes that accommodate more people, that are more fuel efficient, new technologies, but at the same time offer them comfort that they've never seen before. And that's what the Airbus A380 does.
That's Mary Ann Gretchen, a spokesperson, I almost said salesperson for Airbus, telling us about their new plane and denying reports today in the New York Times that the airplane manufacturer is considering these sort of standing only seats on their planes. Mary Ann, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're going to turn now to travel writer Khalil Sakakini for a quick reality check on what we just heard. Khalil, is it true that Airbus and other manufacturers, they're not considering this sort of standing room, you lean against a board seat?
I don't think they really are. Yet with the smoke, there may be fire. I mean, people say, look, in the tube, in the subway, you have to stand up and you're standing next to each other, face to face, armpit to armpit. So maybe eventually at some particular point, that might be a concept. Mm-hmm. But surely it's an indication of how desperate the airlines are to save money, and they're making thinner seats, clearly.
And aren't they shrinking the sections?
They are, because they're not serving food, so they're eliminating the galleys. They don't need the galleys, so they're adding, shrinking in a way. They're shrinking the space, but I think they're adding more seats in order to increase the revenue to help offset the cost of the fuel. They're making thinner seats, and on and on and on it goes. It's a crazy business. I mean, now they're talking about charging overweight people, of course, for a second seat. And it clearly, though, this story is apocryphal. And it originated in somebody's very clever news blog, and there you have it.
And somebody's going to see it on the front of the New York Times and say, hey, great idea.
Yeah, it's already in the Guardian. It's already in the Australian paper. And interestingly enough, the FAA doesn't necessarily require the passengers be seated, only that they be secure. So, again, with the smoke, there may be fire. Who knows if this may be something to look at down the road. But for the moment, it's just not happening.
Travel writer Khalil Sakakini. Khalil, thanks so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here. Now. No, no, there's so much more. Yes, singer and actress Patti LuPone nailed Ava Perón in her Tony Award-winning performance in Evita, but she's been owning her roles for over 25 years. And here she is now as the tuba-playing, villainous, yet oddly at the same time pathetic pie baker in the acclaimed revival of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, the macabre yet entertaining tale of the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Mind you, I can hardly blame them. These are probably the worst pies in London. I know why nobody cares to take them. I should know, I make them, but good now, the worst pies in London.
And Patti LuPone is also a solo performer. A recording of her one-woman show, The Lady with the Torch, is out on CD today.
The other woman finds time to manicure her nails.
And Patti LuPone joins us now from the Argo Network Studios in New York City. Patti, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Your performance in Sweeney Todd is what everyone is talking about. Ben Brantley of the New York Times called it a fiendish delight. How would you characterize how you feel in Sweeney Todd?
Oh, I'm the happiest I've ever been on a stage. It's one of those blessed experiences. Our director, John Doyle, assembled a true ensemble where we have each other's backs, we support and care for each other. The most wonderful thing is that because there's only 10 actors with 10 instruments, there's a minimal amount of sound. So there's no barrier, as we see so much in Broadway theaters now, there's no barrier of sound between the stage and the audience. So it allows the audience to come to the stage, as in the old days, which is electric.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod. Did Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Sweeney Todd has been produced by opera companies. It usually has big orchestration. Your production is receiving a lot of attention because, as you say, it's so small. The actors play all the musical instruments. You play the tuba? Now, I understand you had played the tuba before.
Yes, I played it in the Northport Long Island High School marching band.
Oh, what? Well, I was going to
play the sousaphone, actually.
I was going to say what I would have given to see that, but I maybe did see it because I went to Plainview High School on Long Island.
Oh, now did we play you in sport?
I think we did. And there
well, you
were.
Might have seen. We had an all-girls sousaphone line. I know. It's so sexy, it's scary.
But wait a minute. Weren't you, Patti LuPone, the star of all the high school musicals as well? Why were you playing the tuba?
In high school, the band leader was a graduate of Northwestern University, and he was able to get the most current marching routines. He and a band leader from Herrick's High School decided that they were going to take their high school bands to a band camp. I went when my brothers were in the band, and I thought, this is really sexy. How do I get in on this? Because you'd march all day, and it was dark at night. So I figured, well, I'll get in the band somehow. And then because I was class clown, I went, well, what's the most ridiculous thing I could do? And it was play the sousaphone, and my band leader strapped a sousaphone around my neck, and the rest is history.
Your razor high, screaming, hear it singing, yes. Sick it in the rosy skin of righteousness.
Let's remind people of the Sweeney Todd storyline. The title character, which is played by Michael Cerveris, is a barber who escapes from a false imprisonment only to find that he's lost his wife and his child is in the care of the man who had him arrested and who, by the way, also raped his wife. So Sweeney ends up taking his vengeance on the world by murdering the customers of his barbering business. You play Mrs. Lovett, who takes the bodies and bakes them into pies, which turns out to be a great business. And there's a wonderful song where you come up with that idea. Let's just hear a little.
Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and her pie shop. Business never better, using only pussy cats and toast. Now a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
eminently practical and
not
appropriate as always. Mrs. Lovett, how I did without you all these years, I'll never know.
Think
how
about it, lots of other gentlemen will soon be coming for a shave. Won't they
how
think
choice,
of all
how
them
rare.
Boys?
Oh, what's the sound of...
How would you characterize Mrs. Lovett as you play her?
Well, she's pragmatic. Times are hard. She has to do what she has to do to survive, and she genuinely loves Sweeney, and she will hold on to him at all costs. And it is a dark tale, but I don't think we look at anything. You know, we go through life and hit dark patches, but we don't go, like, this is... We just sort of find our way through it and move on. And I think that there's optimism in both of these characters through the darkness. Well, maybe not on Sweeney's part, but I think that Mrs. Lovett is just glad she's got a man in her life, and now she's got some money in her pocket.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable thing, really, when you think about, you know, a play that's been such a hit so many times that is about people baking people into pies.
Well, I don't know what to tell you about that. I do know that we have a lot of kids in the audience, and we refer to it as the slasher musical. but the kids love it. The kids don't mind the blood. Maybe it's a horror movie. Maybe it's the equivalent of a horror movie that we love to watch.
Well, as you mentioned, Mrs. Lovett, you have your own way of portraying her. And look out. Here's a segue coming. It's sort of you describe her as a lady carrying a torch for Sweeney Todd. Yeah. Which brings us, I don't know how else to get there, to your newest CD, The Lady with the Torch. Why don't we listen to a little, because this is a Patti LuPone some people may not know. We want to listen to I Want to Be Around. It's the Johnny Mercer, Sadie Zimmerman classic.
I want to be around to see how she does it when she breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine.
Patti LuPone singing from her new CD just released today, I Want to Be Around. The Lady with the Torch is the name of the CD, and they smoke these classic songs. What's the appeal of these songs to you?
Scott Whitman, my collaborator on my one-woman shows, wanted me to sing Torch. I, of course, wanted to do bluegrass, but Scott won out. So it's there. I'm a melancholy baby. I'm Italian. There's a strain of sadness in me.
What is that sadness? Because as you said, you know, this was the girl with the tuba in high school and the class clown. So
yeah,
what is that?
I don't
that?
Know. I think it's just ancestral rage. It's the Sicilian witches sitting on my shoulder. I don't know. There is just a melancholy strain in me. And I think it is an essence of why I'm an actor. So torch songs wail in my voice. They sound good in my voice.
You have that big voice. You're an actor and you're Broadway big, you know, the voice that projects. And we've been wondering, you know, we all know that you originated the role of Eva Perón, or Evita, as she was cast in the Broadway musical. But then the role in the film went to Madonna. And I'm wondering, would you like to do more of the film? Would you like to cross over more? Or is Broadway the best place for that thing that's you?
Well, I think the stage is the best place for that thing that is me. But, of course, I would love to have had a movie career because it just, you know, allows you to do more stage because you have bigger box office. But that didn't happen. Film did not happen. I'm not a typical film face or body. And I am supremely at home on the stage.
And as you said, happier than you've ever been in your life on this particular stage. Patti LuPone currently yes. starring on Broadway in the revival of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. Get a ticket if you can. She also has a new CD in stores, The Lady with the Torch. Patti LuPone, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these